Today's hearing will be dealing with the region selection process. There's been a lot of conversations this session about that and some ideas on maybe if the changes or no changes. I guess that's what we'd like to talk about today. And we have, I believe, a couple of regions in the audience. If they want to represent it, or Regent McMillan over there, Rocha over there. Am I missing another? That's it. Well, welcome, and we would begin by, I guess, introducing Nathan Hopkins. Welcome to the committee, and again, formally introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, Nathan Hopkins from the House Research Department. I was asked to give a brief overview of the region election process for the committee. I know that all the committee members are familiar with the process from last year and possibly prior years as well, so I'll keep it brief, but starting off, a brief overview of the composition of the Board of Regents. There's a key distinction that I want to highlight for members here, and that's between aspects of the Board of Regents composition that are determined by the university charter and aspects that are determined by statute. Under aspects that are determined by the university charter have essentially been incorporated into the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, so they can't be changed by a normal act of the legislature like a new statute. However, aspects that are determined by statute can be updated and changed by the legislature. So under the university charter, we have the requirement that the board have 12 regents, that they be elected by a joint convention of the legislature, so that's both the House and the Senate, that they serve six-year terms, although there's no provision for a term limit in the charter. The regents are staggered into three classes, so typically we have four regents that are elected every biennium, although that can change if there are retirements or deaths. And finally, vacancies under the charter are filled by the governor until the next election takes place. Two aspects of the composition of the Board of Regents that are determined by statute are that there should be one member from each congressional district. That means there are eight designated seats, one per congressional district in Minnesota, as well as four at-large seats. The other aspect determined by statute is that one of the at-large seats must be filled by a current university student. A brief overview of the process. There's essentially three steps to electing regents. First, the Regent Candidate Advisory Council, or RCAC, recruits and screens regent candidates. It then makes recommendations on those candidates to a joint legislative committee, and that typically happens by January 15th of each odd-numbered year. The second step of the process is the Joint Legislative Committee. They consider the RCAC recommendations. They can also accept new candidate nominations, and they finally will make recommendations to the Joint Convention. Typically, the Joint Legislative Committee meets by February 28th under statute, but that can vary. The third and final step is the Joint Convention of the Legislature. The Joint Convention receives the recommendations of the Joint Committee. They can also accept new candidate nominations, and finally, they elect regents. And in the past several years, this has happened in early March. An important thing to point out is that both at the second and third stage of the process, new candidate nominations can be accepted in. The Regent Candidate Advisory Council is established by statute. It has 24 members, half of which are appointed by the Senate, half of which are appointed by the House. They serve six-year terms. Though there are student members who serve two-year terms, and those terms are staggered, so typically eight new appointees will be appointed in each even-numbered year, and there is a two-term limit for RCAC members. For each of the chamber's 12 appointees to RCAC, at least one must be a current student. No more than four can be current or former legislators, and no more than eight can be from the same political party, although party affiliation is not required to be stated in order to be an RCAC member. Finally, geographic diversity must, under the statute, be taken into consideration when the body is appointing its RCAC members. The duties of RCAC are to develop selection criteria for region applications. Those have to include diversity in geography, gender, race, occupation, and experience. And second, they will recruit and identify qualified candidates for open positions. Typically, they'll post openings and get candidates and also sometimes reach out to their personal networks. Finally, they'll submit their recommendations after performing interviews and screening candidates to the Joint Legislative Committee by January 15th. And RTAC will recommend 2 to 4 candidates to the Joint Committee for each vacancy. So this shows the basic schedule for how RTAC operates. In the last biennium, for the last election, in September 2016, the call for applications went out and recruitment began. On December 5th, 2016 was the deadline for applications. There was a preliminary screening process where they selected candidates to interview. Public interviews took place on January 4th through 6th of 2017. And on January 13th, 2017, RCAC made its recommendations to the Joint Committee. And here are some of the raw numbers on the bottom here from the 2016-2017 RCAC session. They had 36 total applications for 4 vacancies. They performed 17 interviews and ultimately recommended 12 candidates to the Joint Committee. So the second step in the process after RCAC makes its recommendations is a meeting of the Joint Legislative Committee. And this is controlled by statute and also by joint rule of the House and Senate. It's composed of both the House and Senate higher ed committees, and it's co-chaired by the chair of the House and the Senate committee. It meets by February 28th or by another date set by concurrent resolution. It interviews candidates recommended by RCAC, and it can also accept new nominations. Only committee members, members of the Joint Legislative Committee, can offer new nominations. New nominations require the consent of 3 House members and 2 Senate members on the committee. The duty of the Joint Legislative Committee is to recommend candidates to the Joint Convention. The committee is supposed to recommend no more than 1 candidate for each vacancy. They have to vote via a viva voce roll call vote. And it and in order to be recommended, a candidate must receive a majority of House members and a majority of Senate members. Finally, the statute controlling the Joint Legislative Committee does say that the committee has to consider gender, racial, and ethnic balance on the Board of Regents. So in the last session, during the last round of region elections, this shows a little bit about how candidates flowed through the process. So there were 4 vacancies in the 2nd, 3rd, and 8th congressional district and 1 at-large seat. So on the far left here, we have the people that RCAC recommended to the Joint Committee listed. Incumbent regents have an asterisk next to their name. And on the screen, you can see candidates that are in red ultimately were elected to the positions. No, sorry. They were ultimately recommended to the Joint Convention, not elected. So you see at the committee level, Regent Spigum was nominated at the committee level, even though he wasn't recommended by RCAC. So that sort of shows how that process worked. The third and final step in the three-phase process is a Joint Convention of the Legislature. This is not controlled by statute. It's controlled by Joint Rule 4.02. The Joint Convention collects the nominations for each open seat. Everyone that was recommended by the Joint Committee is automatically nominated for a vacancy, and any member of the legislature can submit additional nominations. The other provisions in Joint Rule 4.02, it requires a viva voce roll call vote on each congressional district seat, and then it moves on to student seats, if any, and then any at-large vacancy seats. The candidate receiving the majority of votes for each seat is elected to the vacancy. This shows the process for the Joint Convention of the Legislature in 2017, what the results were. We see 1 candidate for each seat that was recommended to the Joint Convention by the Joint Committee. In the second column, you have the additional nominations that came on the floor. And the asterisks in that second column are people who were recommended by RCAC but not recommended by the Joint Committee. So you have people that went through the RCAC process and were recommended by RCAC but not recommended by the Joint Committee coming back into the election process through four nominations at the joint convention. And then ultimately elected in the second district, Regent Spigum, in the third, Regent Rocha, in the eighth, Regent McMillan, and the at-large seat, Regent Powell. And so one notable thing here is that Regent Powell was not recommended by the joint committee, but was ultimately elected as a regent because he was nominated on the floor. I wanted to give a little information about previous processes, specifically prior to RCAC. RCAC was instituted in 1988. Prior to RCAC, the process for region election was not as tightly controlled by statute. It was rather informal. There were roughly four phases. In the first, regents would self-nominate for a congressional district seat or an at-large seat, and the nominees would then be reviewed by a caucus of all legislators from that district, which would vote whether to recommend specific candidates. There was then a joint meeting of the House and Senate Education Committees. They'd review the candidates and also accept new nominations, and they would vote whether to recommend candidates for the full legislature. And then finally, at a joint convention, a legislative convention, they would review all recommendations and would be open to any new nominations, and finally elect the regents. RCAC was motivated, the creation of RCAC in 1988 was motivated in part by a 1986 independent study group on the regent selection process that was convened by the Alumni Association for the University of Minnesota. Partially, some of the motivations behind the creation of RCAC were depoliticizing the regent selection process. There was a perception that the region positions were part of a political spoil system, broadening citizen involvement, and also diversifying the region candidate pool. So those were some of the motivations for why RCAC was created in 1988. Finally, one other previous process that the legislature put in place for a brief period of time. In 2005, the governor was given by statute a role in this process. Of course, under the charter, only the joint convention of the legislature can elect regents. But by statute in 2005, the legislature chose to give the governor a role. They formalized the joint committee and provided a role for the governor. So what would happen is RCAC would make recommendations not to the joint committee like they do now. RCAC would make its recommendations to the governor, again, 2 to 4 candidates per vacancy. The governor would then nominate one candidate per vacancy to the Joint Legislative Committee. And the Joint Legislative Committee could only recommend to the Joint Convention candidates that the governor had recommended to it. If the Joint Legislative Committee did not recommend a governor's nominee, the governor had to submit a different nominee for that vacancy. This was a very short-lived process. It went through only one round of elections. The governor's role was eliminated in 2007, but the composition of the Joint Committee was modified, but it was kept in place because the governor's role and the joint committee were formalized in statute at the same time. So after that round of elections, they dropped the governor's role, kept the joint committee, and just modified it. So that's all I have, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Any questions from members? Representative Willis. Before we get to the question, it would be helpful to Princia if, yeah. What? Francesa, sorry, I did it right yet. If you'd have your name tags so she could see them, it would be helpful if she gets acquainted with you. And now we'll go to Representative Whaley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick clarification, and thank you for your presentation, very thorough. On the previous process, you did say it was informal, so nominees, this is number 2 under the second bullet, nominees would be reviewed by a caucus of all legislators from that district. I just want to make sure I understand. That was not in statute anywhere. That was just a practice. That was just what ended up happening, correct?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen, yes, that was not in statute anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Albright, you're next.
Thank you. So just to the last slide in terms of the previous process, I'm just curious, maybe you do or don't know the answer to this, but obviously something wasn't or didn't work by having the governor involved. And I'm just wondering if you know what caused that and what, why? What, why and wherefore of that, if you could elaborate on that, Nathan.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I don't know exactly. I printed out the Journal of the House for that round of elections and have been meaning to go back and watch the video, but I haven't had the chance to do that yet. I will do that, and if I have any inclination based on what happened on the House floor during the joint convention, I'd be happy to follow up with you to see if that gives us any hints.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Okay, if there are no more questions, Mr. Hopkins, you can come back. Right now, Dave Walter is on my list as the next, or Dan, rather. And you can come down, sure. So we have Dan Walter and Lois Josephson with us. And you can go first if you like. And identify yourself officially for the record.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Walter. I live in Burnsville, and I am vice chair of the Regent Candidate Advisory Council. I'm joined by my fellow vice chair, Lois Josephson. I want to call out, we've got a couple other Regent Candidate Advisory Council members in the audience, Jim Erickson and Paul Taylor, who are with us today as well. I want to start off by applauding this committee for talking about this process now. We are, as you know, about to begin another regent selection process later in the year. And I'm in my sixth year on the Regent Candidate Advisory Council, RCAC, and so I've been through three cycles. And I know after you complete the process, there's always a lot of interest and complaints and criticisms and areas of improvement for the process. But that discussion always seems to be pushed off, and so I appreciate that you're taking this up now. I know there's some bills to change the process in some way, so I again applaud you for looking at this process now. As explained, the A in RCAC is the most important part of that name, and it's advisory. We are an advisory council to the legislature. We are established by the legislature. We are all appointed by either the House or the Senate. I think we're both House appointees here with you today. And that's very important to note because, you know, obviously we take our guidance from the legislature in terms of the work that we do. So it's very important, you know, we and at the RCAC, we see our role as starting the process on a merit-based note. There's obviously a lot of interest in the Board of Regents typically. I think this last time, 46 applications for four spots. And so we start that process as in really a screening committee role. So I just want to walk quickly through the process as that presentation that you just had was very good, included most of the details, and I just want to offer some thoughts from the RCAC perspective. So we undertake a six-month process that begins with the work of an RCAC subcommittee that reviews and updates the selection criteria for candidates for the Board of Regents and the application form. That happens every 2 years. That's actually required by statute that we develop the selection criteria and that be used to guide our work and to guide applicants for the regent positions. As I said, we do modify that each cycle to reflect the various needs of the time. Sometimes there are different challenges facing the Board of Regents. We usually hear from the leadership of the Board of Regents. We often hear from the chairs of the higher ed committees as we're beginning that process to figure out what is it that you all are looking for and what is the Board of Regents looking for in additional members. So that's the beginning of that process. That's really like a job description. It includes things like governance experience with large complex organizations, the ability to challenge the status quo and understanding of diversity issues and so forth. In September, the RCAC holds its initial full council meeting. At this meeting, officers are elected, presentations are given regarding the needs for the Board of Regents, and the selection criteria is adopted. Then we also can adopt a meeting schedule for the duration of the process. All meetings of the RCAC are open to the public, held right here in the state office building. The application period opens in September and usually runs through November, oftentimes because this process is always happening In an election year, we always typically extend that application period into December because of that. And then RCAC members are actively involved in recruiting candidates to apply for the seats coming open on the board. That's really one of our job descriptions, that we're all involved in that process. We all have different networks, different organizations that we're part of. So we work on making sure people understand which positions are open and seek out good applicants for those positions. A recruitment committee heads up the outreach efforts, but as I mentioned, all 24 members are really involved in that process. It does include statewide outreach efforts, such as press releases that are sent to a broad network of media outlets, letters to the editor. Your offices all should get communications from us about the positions being open and the application process and forms, and a range of other recruitment efforts. After the application deadline, RCAC members review the candidate application packets, which include responses to essay questions. So it's really a application form that includes, you know, the basics of a resume, and then there are essay questions that are changed each cycle. So that's really the basis with which we go into to determine who should be interviewed as part of the interview process. So that happens in December. And then in early January, usually the first or second week of January, we meet to actually interview those candidates. There are three or four full days of interviews, usually right here in this building again. In the case of each applicant, the RCAC reviews the application packets, references from at least three individuals, and we conduct the interview, which lasts about 45 minutes, featuring an extensive question and answer period. After all of the interviews conclude, the RCAC members discuss and debate the merits of each candidate and then vote on final recommendations, and that's what you see. So that's usually a half day or a day-long process of everyone offering their insights on the various candidates in the interviews, and it's a rather complex voting process, not unlike the joint committee that you use here. I should also then add, after those recommendations are made to the legislature, the RCAC does hold a candidate orientation meeting to help prepare those candidates that the names that have been recommended, so that they understand the legislative phase of the process. That's often one of the biggest hurdles. A lot of people are applying for a position kind of thinking it's a typical appointment process or so forth, but this is a very unique process, and you know, they need to understand they have to knock on 201 doors over here and meet with all of you, and it's a long process and a big time commitment. And so we do our best to help make sure they understand that, and have current regents, former regents, others offer some insights into that. So I think that's all for my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Walter. We may have questions. Maybe we'll just hold those until Lois Josephson has a chance to tell us what she wants to tell us. And Lois, go ahead and identify yourself, and you can include the fact that you're from Fergus Falls.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Lois Josephson, and yes, I am from Fergus Falls and have had the privilege of representation by the chair of the committee. I have also had the privilege of serving on the RCAC for 12 years, so I will complete two terms this December and can shed a little light on the question that you asked about 2005. The other part of that is, just as regent candidates who are submitting their name aren't necessarily all that certain of what they are getting into when they do so, as Mr. Walter referenced, there's a learning curve on the RCAC as well. And I was firmly in it in 2005. That was also prior to term limits on the RCAC. So there were many people serving that had served for a long, long time on it. And that perchance created a culture. Not perchance, it had created a culture. And I think the change to term limits was prudent. That culture was to some degree at play in 2005. There were sitting regents that were not proffered to the governor in 2005. And that that created the turmoil that occurred that year. And as I said, I was in my first term, so that I'll just leave it at that, because I didn't have enough behind-the-scenes background to know too much more than that. I also know we had 46 candidates this last time, or applicants, rather. There were probably double that at that point. Would be inclined to say, an assumption, that the challenging aspect of interfacing with the legislature and the challenging aspect of the reference checks and the challenging aspect of what it's like to be in a very public arena in the years that have gone by since 2005 has changed, and candidates maybe aren't as willing to step forward as they were in the past. The closing speaker for today could shed some more light on that experience. So, still plenty of candidates. I come predisposed to say that we want to make this state be the best state that it can be. And for that to be the case, our University of Minnesota has to be at the helm helping that to happen. And as a result, the people who are leading it need to have a sense of the citizenry. So the fact that the first funnel of candidates coming into this is coming through a voice of citizens recruiting them, in my opinion, is critically important. And that's not in any way to say that those of you seated around this table are not citizens serving in a citizen legislature. But the mere fact of election changes your perception in society to some degree. The second component is that the process of recruiting candidates is a public relations opportunity, in my mind, for the university and for the state to share what the vision for the state is, and that the leadership of this critical institution is being chosen, and the opportunity that this institution has to do these things for the state are present. And if you have commitment and skill sets in that arena, think about this. So that public relations component is a piece that I think the RCAC has leveraged and could leverage even further than it has. We look for the most qualified candidates. In my mind, we need to be looking for very strategic thinkers, people with keen insight and sharp minds, because they have to come abreast of a massive institution, no matter how large their previous experience has been with complexity. The university is very complex, and they have to have the kinds of minds that can dig into that, do homework, and then react to it not in a management manner, but in a governance manner. And first and foremost in that process is the asking of strategic questions. So those are the things that I, as an RCAC member, looked for in candidates. I'd like to go to the asking of strategic questions piece. Mr. Walter referenced the fact that we serve at the behest of the legislature and are intended to smooth a process and make it broad, well-honed, and effective for you. It would be wonderful to have more insight from you than we, in my opinion, have had during my time period as to what you wanted the RCAC to do. We meet, as Mr. Walter referenced, with university regents beforehand to say, where are the gaps on the board, and what are the challenges coming up that you would like to have some skill sets in? Worthy information. But at the same time, that's a big ship. If there's a sense that the ship ought to change direction to some degree, you're getting insight from the people that are currently operating it. So having insight from you folks to mesh with that guidance from the sitting regents would be helpful. We then go forward, as Dan outlined, with regular process for reaching into the public realm. And I'd like to just share some personal background as to how I worked with the 7th Congressional District opening. I happened to serve on the RCAC through the 7th Congressional District. We had an opening after 12 years in that congressional district, thinking about my personal viewpoint of the economic driver of the state that the university can be. We say that with regularity. Then let's try find a regent from regent candidates from the 7th Congressional District that fully understands the 7th, that can voice all aspects of it, that is well connected to its economic underpinnings, and can bring that to bear while simultaneously serving for the entire state as a regent and not serving as a voice of the 7th. To that end, I added to the regular roster, contacted all of the chambers of commerce, all of the economic development directors, acquired multiple manufacturing rosters, wrote to the CEOs of those manufacturing rosters. And it was a very interesting process that came forward. What ultimately occurred is a well-connected gentleman with long history with the university threw his hat in the ring and interfaced with his local economic development committee. And a fellow regent, as Mr. Walter referenced, used his state and national association experience to reach to a colleague that was in the region. And those were our two candidates. I share that because the election was rather close, and a very good regent was elected. The person that was not elected is worthy of reconsideration, in my opinion. So to you, as you think about what the future is, think about some people that were close and didn't necessarily make it because they could still fit. And then we have other aspects that come up for the RCAC literally every time around. They're unanswered questions, to some degree they're points of challenge. We have the right to send 2 to 4 candidates. And so we ask, we've chosen to interview people that we felt were qualified. We've come through this, and yes, there's probably 4 that could be qualified in many instances that we'd be happy to send forward. But do you want 4? Lots of times there's been the feedback that, oh, gosh, all these people coming into the office and just so busy, so maybe you only want 2. But we're reading between the lines. We don't have your guidance as to whether you want 2, 3, or 4. We don't have your guidance as to what degree do you want us to use our best judgment and call. So our rosters going forward to you have varied. Then we have the statutory requirement that we send at least 2. This last election period, that was a nearly insurmountable challenge. The chair of the recruitment committee, who happens to be Mr. Taylor that is here, and I were both very actively engaged in making call after call after call to any organization that we could find within the 8th Congressional District to recruit a second candidate, because none were coming through on their own. The feedback from those telephone calls was, why would we do that? We have an absolutely fine sitting regent. Talk to us 6 years from now. So to that end, leveraged personal contacts through the region and identified a firmly qualified candidate that was slightly interested or maybe even more than slightly interested in 6 years from now. And said, you have nothing to lose by trying this time and learning what it is like. So that's how two candidates came through the door. So what would you have wanted us to do? To say, we're at one, and we know we have a statutory requirement for two, but we're at one. That's something that could be helpful to learn about from you. Where does our role begin and end? We are an advisory committee to you. In my mind, that means we're not political. There are political stripes within us, and that's something that maybe you'd like to comment with, because we can feel it as we function. And one of the circumstances in the past led to us putting in place criteria as to where our role ends and how we function as individuals thereafter. And I think the final piece would be an experience that most of us hadn't had, occurred in the last 6 years, and that's where increasingly we were being lobbied as you are lobbied by candidates. And so having a little bit of a sense of what your expectation of us is in those regards would be helpful. Be happy to field any questions along with Mr. Walter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lois. And I think we do have some questions before we go on to the next testifier. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions. This is for either one of you or both of you. How do you respond to criticism that the Region Advisory Council has become a rather clever screening process to ensure that a certain type of regent comes out of your process? A regent, shall we say, subservient to the administration or in league with a particular element of the university. What's your response to that?
Mr. Walter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I will go back to my opening comments. Is you know, this is a creature of the legislature, and I will say there are within the university community, they very much work our process. They're very much involved in the process. I think it would be helpful to have a, you know, if there is more of a. I don't know how to refer to it, more of an element towards challenging that status quo. We need to hear from them as well. I will say the process that is in place is a barrier to a lot of people. It is months of time. If they make it through, you know, they go through our process over a number of months and then spend 2 or 3 months up here meeting with legislators. That's a barrier to a lot of people that I think could offer a lot of lot to the. To the Board of Regents. So, your basic question, if that is the sense, if that is the concern from the legislature too, I think it's important to be mindful of the appointees to the Region Candidate Advisory Council and what our charge is as appointees. That's how I.
Joseph, did you have a comment?
That is where I was. Directing my comments in referencing we'd like to hear more from
Mr. Chair, just an observation on that answer, and then I have one more question. You have had, or you should have seen, bills introduced by legislators that created the Region Advisory Council that have been extremely critical of the Region Advisory Council. So your statement about this is a creation of the legislature, it would appear that the legislature thinks its creation has morphed into something that it didn't want. So my second question is this. How do you explain the legislature repeatedly and in numerous elections rejecting your candidates, rejecting them on multiple levels, picking someone who has never gone through your process, or saying we're going to reject your candidate and put somebody else in? How do you explain the increasing inevitability of that if your process is valid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we fully understand that this is a political process. and you know, I'm somebody who works in politics in my day job, so that's not a swear word to me. I understand that's how democracy works, and so forth. So I think our record on that, actually, we testified before the Higher Ed Committee in the Senate yesterday, and typically I think it was three of the four each time is somebody that makes it goes through the RCAC process. But that's obviously yours to determine if that's going to be something that you add to the list of merits that you're looking for in a candidate if they go through this process, because it is a very deliberate strategy by some to bypass this process, and that's not my position to evaluate. I think that's all of yours.
Mr. Chair. My addition to that would be to say that the fact that the statute allows you to add and not be bound by what we send has been very much in the front of our minds as recommendations were made on more than one occasion where, okay, this is the sense of the body here. We haven't tied the hands of the legislature. If the legislature wants to do something else, they can. So chagrin is not felt from my perspective. If I understand where you're going, Representative, but no, it doesn't to me translate as a failure.
Any follow-up?
Later.
Okay. I was just thinking in your first question, I think it's almost universal that the applicants that are applying to be a regent have some love, past history, some connection to the university, some reason for wanting to be there. I don't know if that is addressing the question or not, but I think that's just a natural connection that's there. Otherwise, that's how I look at it anyway, if that makes sense. Any other questions for these two? Yes. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. Great to have some history over time. I appreciate that. Has there ever been a time when there have been, when the recommendations are ranked?
Say that one more.
When the recommendations are ranked, the candidates? Because I know in other hiring situations, there could be a committee that reviews and interviews candidates, and instead of passing on three all the same. And I'm thinking of the situation where there was one candidate that was so strong that it was even hard to find a second person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you had four people and one was clearly better and the other three maybe were on the same level, or have there ever been ranking in the past, or is there something in statute or by how you're set up?
Ranking.
You know, first choice, second choice, third, fourth.
Ms. Josephson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we've talked about that, and going to the deference to this body, we have not done it because we felt like you have the flexibility to add people, you have the flexibility to do your own ranking in your minds, and our part is not to play God any more than maybe some people think we already do. So that's where we have come down. Is that your recollection?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do distinctly remember some discussions about that in our proceedings, but it has, like Ms. Josephson said, it's really been it's not something that the council has embraced, but if that's something that would help the legislature, it's certainly in the prerogative, I think, of the RCAC to rank if that's the desire. I mean, we still, as Ms. Josephson said, at one point I said I've been here three cycles. The first time we had very clear direction from I believe it was the Senate committee chair at that time, do your job, send us no more than two for each spot. Mm-hmm. This most recent time, it was a little bit of a change. There had been some criticism of the process the time before that we were playing too much of a screening role. So that's why you got four candidates for many of them, because there was a certain degree of reaction to some of that. There was a sense that there was the desire for more candidates. But I think that actually would be a helpful Mm-hmm. If it helps up here, it might be a challenge to get all of our people to agree to a certain ranking, but, you know, right. Nothing's easy.
So,
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make the observation that when I, you know, I did meet with the candidates and they spent the time to get on my calendar, to find time and sit down with me. But I would say that even though I had those one-on-one meetings, you actually have more information available to you than I could gather in those meetings. For instance, you know, I had not met with the chair of the Senate committee about what the criteria were that we were looking for. And I was applying, you know, had to think of what my own criteria were, even though selecting a region for the University of Minnesota as a freshman representative wasn't something I knew I was going to have to deal with in my first session. So so I guess one thing as an observation coming into this process, I didn't feel like I had a lot of information about people, and that you went through this intensive process to collect information, to vet, and not very much information is passed on to us other than their names and their training to go and win the election is how it comes to us and how they're able to adapt to winning those elections. So just an observation about how the process worked for me.
I don't recall during the kind of the walkthrough, but another element of this process is the congressional districts. They will have a caucus to help select who they choose from that part of the state to move forward.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think there are some congressional districts that do and some that do not.
That's the other point, yeah. Yeah, but it is an option for some. Any other questions? Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have missed some information, so I apologize if you have to repeat something, but you had mentioned that the council checks with the existing regent board in terms of recommendations and such. Is that something that the legislature directed your group to do, or what's the history there? Why is that happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heitzman, no, not on specific candidates. We hear from the board in terms of what they perceive to be the needs on the board. For example, the example that comes most clearly to mind is medical experience. Obviously, there's a large enterprise with the medical school and the hospital at the University of Minnesota, and one of the regents going off was somebody who had experience in that. So they raise those kinds of qualities. Agricultural experience is often one as well. Just things that kind of so that the board encompasses the full scope of the mission, so to speak. So it's not that they're saying, hey, appoint this guy. That doesn't happen. Some, you know, like Ms. Josephson said, there is lobbying done behind the scenes all the time on that sort of thing. So that occasionally happens, but it's certainly not a formal process. And we get calls from others as well, in addition to regents, in terms of making recommendations on specific candidates. That's often how, people get on the radar, so to speak, beyond just the paper application.
Ms. Josephson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I'm sorry, Representative. I can't see your name.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pryor referenced the fact that she was doing her first regent selection process, and it just hadn't crossed her mind, quite logically, that was going to be part of what happens here. And so going to having the university regents come over, we have 8 members, as the introductory statement from Mr. Hopkins said, who come on new every time. And in order to do a vetting of quality individuals, you need to understand that for which you are vetting. And they, too, just like Representative Pryor, have knowledge, but perchance limited knowledge, of the breadth of the university and firmly not insight into its governance, because that isn't something that an average citizen necessarily knows. So part of having the sitting chair and vice chair frequently of the Board of Regents come and talk to us is providing some of that background at the very beginning of this process, so that as all 24 of the RCAC members do, as Mr. Walter said, help with the recruiting process. They're comfortable with what it is that they're recruiting for.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You can have a follow-up, Representative Heitz, Mr. Chair. You can have two.
I might take you up on that.
Okay.
Thank you. So part of my question was, is that something that the legislature placed in front of you as a group that needed to be consulted throughout this process? Because, and this may sound a little sharp, I don't mean it to, but, you know, there are lots of folks when I go home, and I'm talking about this process, I'll scoot the mic a little closer. When I go home and talk to constituents about this process, there are those that definitely feel that the institution already has a lot of say in how it is governed. It's a land-grant institution. It makes it a lot of decisions for itself. This is one of the very few places that the legislature has an opportunity to have a say in how the university may possibly go forward in terms of the decision makers. So if you're asking the folks that are already there at the institution, already have a significant amount of say, what more do you want? It doesn't make any sense. That's why I was wondering if it was a legislature or others that had directed the RCA to go ahead and to seek their input, which I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just trying to understand better.
Ms. Josephson.
Mr. Chair. Yes, I knew that was where you were going with the question, and it is a very valid question. My honest answer, and I'm inclined to think Mr. Walters might be, that the answer is tradition, and that it precedes my 12 years and firmly precedes his. And so in my comments, I made reference to the fact that being able to sit down with you folks in that very beginning time period in September, just like we sit down with the university, would be more than logical. And yes, there's, it's talking about who's watching the hen house. You know, I know what you're saying. I would not back off the fact that as an RCAC person, I have found it beneficial to hear what you can perceive about the culture of that institution and of the regent institution and what you learn about the university through those presentations. Both of those pieces of information have been helpful. Should they be singular? No, I do not think they should be.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to some extent that does answer my question. I appreciate that it may very well be tradition that dictates who is being requested for adding information into the process. I might have a little bit different take on that coming to the legislature, you know, a little bit different than maybe what Representative Pryor suggested. I was eager to have a say at what happened at the university. And there was a part of me that was interested in what the RCAC recommendation was, but I have, you know, just on a personal level, I want to know more of the detail around their qualifications, you know, just background check kind of information. That was helpful. I mean, you don't want to make a mistake, something that might not be readily available in a Google search. I expect you to find that. But when they come to my office, I think that's kind of where my interest ended, in that I wanted, assuming that you guys had vetted somebody, I wanted them to be able to find out who they were as a person, what their values, and how they might reflect the concerns of the folks that I have to represent at home. That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You did well.
Appreciate that.
I have a couple other questioners. Okay. I was just going to say, part of the process, and I don't think this has been touched on either, I remember how thorough the background checks were done. The members, they divide up, take members, and they really go through a very lengthy process, time-consuming, to verify the references and really find out who these people are. It's like they were applying to be a president of a university. I mean, it's pretty intense. I think that's important. It really is. I think Representative Schultz is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the biggest criticisms from this last round was the lack of diversity in the candidates that were put forward by the joint legislature. And I'm wondering if you can comment on how you ensure diversity of the candidate pool and the candidates you recommend, and maybe also speak about the diversity of RCAC itself and how can we better increase the diversity of members to RCAC.
Mr. Walter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think you've raised, if you went and asked the 24 members of the RCAC what the biggest challenges are we face, you would always get the diversity issue raised in one of the top issues of concern. It's something we have struggled with. We acknowledge that our recruitment efforts are very deliberately focused we reach out to media publications that represent communities of color and other that reach targeted populations and such. So we've done a number of things there, but that's certainly something we can always have some help with and or seek out help from the legislature and others. We have had some discussions in the interim since the last discussion about, there's a chief inclusion officer here with the state working with that person. There are ethnic councils that have a role to play that could be helpful in that regard. So I think through the next cycle, we will be doing a lot more in that regard. Your final question about the diversity of the RCAC itself, that is a glaring point, I think, to most folks. There's not a lot of diversity on the RCAC. So that's certainly something, as the House appoints half of the RCAC, the Senate appoints the other half. I would just encourage that to be something that's taken into consideration when you appoint us.
Representative Schultz, any follow-up? Oh, sorry. Ms. Schultz.
Mr. Chair. I am the vintage of having been a youth and a woman when youth and women were beginning to be allowed on public bodies and in positions of leadership. I benefited tremendously from being able to kill two birds with one stone. And so I know what a conscious effort by a body attempting to change its makeup can do for individuals that benefit from that. I'm speaking as myself and not as a member of a body for the body. I'm able. I was not a weak link on anybody that I served on. Was I the strongest link in that organization? No, at that point in my life, I was not. Has it enabled me to do other things later in my life that maybe paid back that benefit from that period? Yes. So, to your point, as we sit working on your behalf to identify the strongest candidates who can come in and slice to the core of a complex institution, not in a management way, but in an insightful way of asking questions, have the steel in their spine to stand up to an institution that has a strong, strong administrative structure, needs to have a strong administrative structure, and has operated as an administrative institution with governance oversight. If that person is going to function on a board and want to do so in a way that May, as Representative Hintzman, was alluding in his comments, they need to have certain personal characteristics. And I just named several of them, and they have nothing to do with the color of skin. It has happened, and this last time was no different, that there were candidates before us that were exceptionally strong people. And yet as it comes to what do we do here with this pool, sometimes the decision becomes there's another year for that candidate. And that can take a pool that started out with some diversity in it down to one that doesn't end up being diverse. Is that right? Is it wrong? I don't know. But that's something that can happen in that decision process.
Representative Schultz.
Okay, thank you for that. Do we need to prioritize that? Because in my opinion, the Board of Regents needs to reflect the diversity of the university. And that means the students, the employees, everyone there. And it's a very diverse organization. So I think we can gain a lot by making sure we have not only people of color represented on the board, but even gender diversity. And we lack even gender diversity. So I'm looking for your opinion on what we can do as the legislature to change the process so we can get strong, qualified people that reflect the university population.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Josephson?
I would go to the September through November 15 timeframe and ask the legislators very actively recruit and send nominations in through the process.
Mr. Walter, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I think yes is the answer to your question. I think if that's obviously is something that is reflected in all of our materials and so forth. It's a very much a focus of what we do. Playing off of what Ms. Josephs had said, I do think some help in recruiting would be part of that, and then also the makeup of the RCAC. This ties in a roundabout way to one other point that I want to make, because it ties into the recruiting point. And as Representative Pryor observed, the Regent election process happens right at the beginning of a new legislature. We've had a great deal of political fluidity in the three times I've been through this cycle, 6 years. Every time we've had a change of party in one house of the legislature or not. I would say a simple thing that change that could be made that would greatly enhance this process and help with all the recruitment efforts and so forth, as it would engage a lot more people in the process, is to move that to this year, move it to the bonding years. So it's not, you know, we're not competing with the budget. Because I will also say, in talking to legislators that I know, Regents election is not high on the priority the September before an election or the first 2 weeks of the legislative session of a budget year when we are doing the bulk of our work. So sometimes, you know, it's conceivable we make these recommendations of candidates to you and the entire climate environment has shifted, so to speak, in that week. And then also from a recruitment perspective, you know, we send our materials, the postings for these positions, which positions are open to your offices. But again, that's September before an election. And so I'm just saying, you know, I'm not implying anything politically there. I'm just saying we need to consider freeing up some bandwidth as to when appropriate time can be focused on this issue. That makes sense.
Representative Albright.
To the extent that it's been answered before, just let me know. But the RCAC, by its name, implies advisory. And to the extent that Representative Schultz, Representative Pryor, Representative Heintzman have all expressed this desire, to what extent you're obviously taking instruction and or suggestions from the current regents, but also from the legislature in terms of what you're looking for. But to the extent, isn't the RCA's charter also to think upon what the university needs in terms of leadership, in terms of due diligence, in terms of, to your point, Ms. Josephson, a steely spine? rather than in a political process, make it an apolitical by possibly inserting some of your own observations about what might be necessary. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about that, or if you're already inserting some of that flavoring or seasoning into the process as you go through consideration of candidates, consideration of what the Board of Regents needs, and how various candidates might fulfill those obligations or those needs of the regions for possibly as many as 6, 8, 10 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the answer for me is, maybe I'm strange, but I think about those kinds of things all the time. So for me as an individual, that's the way I operate. And from point of observation with the others over the years, I mean, it rotates in membership quite a bit. I have seen many, many others on that body that function like I do. So I think you can be comfortable that that occurs. Are there others who may think through a lens of agenda over the years? Have there been? Yes, there have been. But the great majority think that way.
Thank you. All right. Representative Haley, you have a question?
Is it time, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And some of this might have been covered. I'm new to the process. I found it very lengthy, complex, and not necessarily productive. So I appreciated your suggestion of it could be moved to happen in this part of the biennium. That made a ton of sense to me. And I appreciate all your suggestions on what could be changed, because I like to, I guess, begin with the end in mind. And the end in mind is, does this process serve the university well? Does it serve the state well? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm interested if you could answer both of those questions, because I feel like that's what we need to get to. And my second part of it is, in your length of time, both of you have quite a tenure in this, are you aware of how other states conduct this process? Is there a better practice out there that we could look at?
Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Haley, your first question about does it serve the university or does it serve the state, you know, obviously we're speaking from the RCAC perspective, so not over the entirety of the process. I think both. I think both go hand in hand. Obviously, we're not the body that's there to make the political considerations. That's really when it comes over here. So I think I see our job as providing the best candidates for that spot. I do agree that there are some challenges in the recruitment front, and we need to ensure that we are getting a good and robust group of applicants for that. But I think both. And, you know, this is a very open and public process. It's not done in secret. I have told people a number of times that there's plenty of points where you can influence the process. If you think there's a problem at the university, if there's a skill we should be looking at, we are, you know, it's a public process. So we would encourage that that level of participation. And there was a second question. Oh, other states. This is a unique process. I think I haven't actually, I work in other state governments with other state governments for my day job, and I can say state like Michigan, it's on the ballot. They elect the trustees for their public universities on the ballot. It's a direct election. It's a partisan election. I don't know that anybody is advocating for that or would want that. Others then are similar to like the Minsky process here, which is a gubernatorial appointee confirmed by the Senate. There's a wide range, but again, to your first question, I think the uniqueness of the structure in Minnesota shows the priority that has always been put on the University of Minnesota, that this is a unique process. This is the only time I think you have to come into a joint convention is to do this function. So I think that is really a historical priority that's been put on this process. And again, I think it's, we're an advisory council. We're here to do what you want us to do. So if there are significant changes to that, Obviously, that's and I know there are bills to do that. That is certainly the decision to be made. But I think I speak for all 24 of us that we don't do this role for glory. It's a rather challenging job, and you walk around the state office building, and when people find out that you're on the RCAC, it's always kind of a somber look because it's not the most well-respected or plumb role in state government by any means. So I think I speak for us, though, in saying we're willing to be part of the process in the future as we have been in the past, and if there are improvements that need to be made, we obviously will do that. Sorry, that was a little long-winded.
I know we have one more testifier, and we really have appreciated the answers. Is there a follow-up for Representative Haley? Okay. Is there any concluding comments from either of you that we really appreciate what you've shared with us today?
Mr. Chair, my conclusion would be that this system may not be perfect. We've discussed ways that it can be improved. But I firmly think that the citizen interface on the front end is very, very powerful.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for being here. I don't know if he wants to be identified or not. We have a former regent in the audience who we identified the regents, and Tom Devine, raise your hand. There you are. Okay. Now we'll invite Darren Rocha down here next. You've got 20 minutes.
All right.
Or less.
I was going to say, talk to our chair. Can I do anything in 20 minutes, Chair McMillan? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you guys a bit here today. Following that, I think, a little bit more sort of structural conversation, I want to talk a little bit more about the actual process. I think I come before you today in somewhat of a unique position because I've had over 30 years' experience.
Before we get going, we have to have a formal introduction.
Oh, I am sorry. Yeah. Mr. Chair, my name is Darren Rocha. I am the 3rd District Regent. I live in Independence, Minnesota.
Perfect.
I'm a Gemini.
That's good.
Thank you. I've been a part of this process for over 30 years. As I think virtually everyone here knows, I serve as the 3rd District Regent, elected in 2015 and reelected in 2017. Also, I don't know that everybody knows, but thanks in part to folks like Representative Pawlowski, I also served on the board from 89 to 95. After I returned from Iraq with the Red Bulls in 2010, we reestablished my business and family life in Western Hennepin County. And having kept up with the university since I left the board in 95, I looked up who was serving as the 3rd District Regent and noticed that it was Regent David Larson, and he lived right down County Road 6 from me. So I contacted the board office and struck up a relationship with him and a friendship, and he actually became a bit of a mentor. And we would get together monthly. We'd talk about the university and some things with his career. Well, when Regent Larson passed away unexpectedly, a small bipartisan group of legislators who knew that I'd previously served as a regent and knew Regent Larson, they suggested that I should seek to fulfill his unexpired term, knowing, one, that I would maybe have a shorter learning curve because I'd been a regent before, but also that I'd have a unique historical perspective on the university from a couple decades earlier. And I told them that I was flattered by the inquiry, but I was concerned that maybe it's not the best time with a young family and work, but as all of you know, it's when is public service the right time? It will, sort of step on just about anything you've got going. So people have to step up and take these positions. But I did tell them that I really had no interest in going through the RCAC process. My observation of the process since about 1995 as I was leaving the board led me to believe that it did not operate in the fashion that it was supposed to. For many years, and I also believe that it was an unpleasant experience for candidates, and it discouraged some quality candidates from seeking to serve as regents. Over time, it appeared to develop sort of its own politics that has been more troubling to me than what was prior to that, and I'll explain that a little bit. In the late 80s, the university, as many of you might recall, was going through some difficult times. I know we heard a bit earlier from, I believe, Mr. Hopkins, that the Alumni Association had weighed in on having more input into the region selection. There were some other issues going on at the university at the time. And so the legislature really looked to the Board of Regents as a way of trying to make the university more accountable. And the way that they did that was to create this process to find, quote-unquote, qualified candidates for the Board of Regents to serve on the board of the flagship land-grant research university for the state. Well, I became involved in student government just prior to that, and I was serving at the time as the non-voting student elected representative from the St. Paul campus out of the College of Ag, and one of my peers had nominated me to the open seat for the student-at-large seat on the board. This was after I had nominated her. I would have preferred she had run and been elected, but nonetheless, here we are. So I actually went through the very first RCAC process, and it was very impressive. The board was, as it is now, and I do want to point out that it's a little uncomfortable because I do think that the previous speakers, Ms. Josephson and Mr. Walter, are excellent individuals. They do very good work on the council, and there are a lot of things, as I think you kind of got from their testimony, are a bit out of their control. And I also hesitate to raise questions about a process that produces quality folks like Regent McMillan, who we've heard has endeared himself to every individual resident of the 8th District. Anyway, so you can see that the process does produce quality results in instances. But anyway, so, you know, the folks that were on the council at the time, they were from education, both public and private. They were leaders in business, nonprofit community, even the faith communities, and they're from all over the state. The community was well advertised, and as I recall, there were over 100 applicants for four open seats. And when you look at the statute, it says it's to assist determining criteria for identifying and recruiting qualified candidates for membership of the board. In doing so, RCAC is to recommend two and no more than four candidates for each seat. Now, this is important. As Representative Lynn Carlson, who is one of the authors of the original bill, will tell you, the number two was put in there because they originally said, well, we want four. We want the legislature to have a range of choices so that the legislature can execute its constitutional duty. Some people were concerned, well, what happens, as we saw in the 8th, what happens if you don't have four candidates? So then they said, well, we'll do two. But ultimately, the responsibility was to produce a slate of candidates. Now, back in that first cycle, the RCAC, out of that 100-some applicants, interviewed 64 candidates. That's 16 candidates for every seat, and then recommended four for each seat, and I and three others were elected out of that pool. And it went well in 91 and 93, where RCAC was putting forward a full slate of candidates. The one exception was the 8th District incumbent, Tom Reagan. There were only two in that seat, as he was an incumbent. I believe that may have had a big part in that. But in 1995, things took a turn. And despite a large number of applicants, RCAC only recommended two candidates for each, the fifth and the at-large student seat, and five candidates for the two at-large seats when eight could have been recommended. But there's more, because for the student seat, there were over a dozen applicants, and people were contacting me about a couple things. One, was I going to run again? And I didn't. And the other one was, well, how do I run to get elected to your seat that is opening up? So I knew that there were a lot of really quality students from multiple campuses, student government experience, other experience. And so RCAC only recommended two, which artificially, in my view, limited what the legislature had to select from. But what's worse, and this had a pretty profound impact on my perspective, even 20 years later, one of the most conscientious, hardest-working regents that I had served with was not recommended by RCAC. A sitting regent was not recommended. Now think about that. This is an accomplished woman. 6 years earlier had been recommended as qualified by RCAC. Served for 6 years as a regent, suddenly RCAC determined she was not qualified. Now, they left three nominations vacant. They could have nominated eight for the at-large seat, but they only did five. So it was kind of a pretty strong message to regents, I think, where they say, well, if you're not operating the way we think you ought to, we're going to deem you unqualified. And from a logical standpoint, you cannot possibly say someone who was qualified, gained 6 years of experience, became unqualified. It's absurd. And so it either reflects a terribly flawed process or an intent to go beyond qualifications and replace the legislature in deciding the approach regents should take moving forward. And so just remember, anytime the RCAC doesn't present a full slate of candidates, despite having candidates who applied but were not recommended, they're logically saying those people were just simply unqualified to serve as members of the board. I'll come back to that. So after 95, RCA refused, or however you want to say it, did not forward the names of at least two more incumbents who previously had been recommended as qualified. I think that disrespects the legislature, because if the legislature has come forward and said, this person is not only qualified, but we want them to serve, I think the legislature should have the opportunity to determine whether that person performed in the way the legislature feels is appropriate. You know, my argument is, you know, there's no qualification for climbing Mount Everest like having climbed Mount Everest, and these people had served on the board. I also think it's important to note, and this goes to Regent Schultz's point, among the at least three incumbents that were blocked for re-election by RCAC, two were very well-qualified women, and one was a woman of color. So for the over 40 positions that have been considered by RCAC in the meantime, a full slate of non-duplicated candidates for a specific position has only occurred twice. Only two times out of 40 has there been a full slate for the legislature to consider. Mr. Walter had mentioned that there was a 4-for-1 in this last cycle, but that included a candidate who was in two different categories. So you can, you know, assess that as you will. You know, this is a difficult conversation because there have been many conscientious, high-quality people who have diligently performed their duties in RCAC. Nonetheless, it's inconsistent with our constitutional charge to the legislature for RCAC to have developed this kind of strange politics that was not intended in its creation, and I don't think it actually helps us very much. This brings us back to 2015. So at the urging of some supporters, I got over my fears. I submitted my application. I felt pretty good about my responses to the questions and the quality of my references. A few weeks later, I was bemused to receive a call from an RCAC member telling me I was not selected for an interview. For curiosity, I asked how many people had applied for the 3rd District seat, and I was told 6 or 7. That means 6, I figured. I then asked how many would be interviewed, and I was told 3 or 4. I was amused to think that after 6 years of serving as a regent, 4 degree programs and 3 degrees at the U, and 20 years of experience in life, business, service, RCAC had decided, based on my written submission, that an interview was unwarranted because there is no possible way I could serve as a University of Minnesota regent. But I took it in stride and figured it was just simply the gentle hand from above telling me I should focus on family and work, National Guard, and let other people deal with these politics. But when the names were announced and only two candidates were recommended, I was mortified that Bill Luther, who I had never met, was not included. Don't get me wrong, the two nominees that were recommended are remarkable people and clearly qualified to serve as outstanding regents, but how can RCAC or anyone else say that Bill Luther, a former member of this body, is not qualified to serve as a university regent? At that point, my small bipartisan group of legislators suggested that I would enter the race, which I did. And it bears mentioning that once I was endorsed by the 3rd District legislators, some folks involved with RCAC did some things that they should not have in an effort to prevent me from being elected. As many of you recall, Mr. Luther also entered the race without RCAC recommendation, and he and I made it to the 3rd and final ballot for the 3rd District seat, with Bill receiving 96 votes to my 98, and he was the first person to congratulate me. One might think things would have moderated after that outcome, but in 2017, the intrigue continued. Historically, I believe, and this we heard about a minute ago, that it's a challenge for RCAC to attract candidates to oppose an incumbent. Fair enough. So when the 2017 election yielded no opposition in the regular time frame for the 8th District seat with Regent McMillan, I wasn't very surprised. By contrast, however, when running for re-election in my district, there were 8 opponents for a total of 9 candidates, and that's in addition to the calls I received from other people telling me that they had been heavily recruited to run against me by members of the RCAC and others so associated. Fair enough. I respect that we should have a full and vigorous campaign. But at the close of the original application period, there was still only one candidate for the 8th District seat. So RCAC extended the application period under the guise of trying to seek candidates for the 8th district, and but they said, to be fair, we're going to leave it open for all 4 seats that are open. After the extended period expired, you can guess how many more candidates they had for the 8th district. 0. Remarkably, there were 7 more candidates for the 3rd district seat that the person that had been elected without RCAC approval had been elected to 2 years prior. And so in the 3rd district, you now have 16 candidates, which out of 36 is almost half of the candidates recruited by RCAC were directed to the election that I was running for. These recruitment numbers might suggest something other than an objective and honest effort to simply aid the legislature in finding good candidates. However, the most disturbing occurrence in the 2017 process, from my perspective, is that Bill Luther, who again applied for the at-large position, was not even granted an interview. Not even an interview. Now think about that. That same person, 20-some months earlier, less than 2 years earlier, 49% of you in the legislature had voted, saying not only is he qualified to be a regent, you want him to be a regent. But yet the RCAC determined he was so utterly unqualified he didn't deserve an interview. I don't understand how this can happen. So they just simply believe that you were wrong when you voted in 2015. Whether by design or if it's just a process that leads to these kinds of results, the people of Minnesota probably deserve a little better than that. Before I conclude, I want to identify a few things about the actual process. I've been through it three times, sort of, over 18 years. The process is remarkably invasive and uncomfortable. Chair Nornes, you talked about how it's good to get this information. I agree. Information is good. But let's look at this process. I would actually suggest that it's more invasive and certainly more aggressive than my military security clearance process. Somebody not of your choosing, possibly with animus toward your campaign or a bias in favor of a different campaign, is given power on behalf of state government to call people at will. And it's not just your references. They can call anybody that they think might have input on you, whether good or bad. They may ask the references for references and contact them. And when they're talking to these people, they literally ask them, tell me something negative about this candidate. Now, I do think some candidates probably are spared from this, but certainly others are subjected to that kind of inquiry. Then, without any opportunity for the candidate to respond to the feedback from these unknown sources, because they're not given that feedback, that somebody then gives a report on the candidate, again without the candidate present, to the rest of the RCAC. What's more, the candidates for a single seat don't have the same investigator or reporter. So the candidate who gets a strong supporter with good communication skills and enthusiasm, for them the prospects are really good. For somebody who has someone with a hidden bias and or a less persuasive style, it could be a lost cause. In short, there's no analogous process anywhere, and that's for a reason. I don't think anybody sitting here would want to go through a process of that variety. A criminal background check and perhaps an evaluation of potential conflicts is reasonable, but frankly, I believe candidates should be representing themselves and their candidacy should stand on their own. Finally, as it relates to the RCAC process, I point out that there are significant functions of the Board of Regents that are not promoted by this process. First, it's imperative that the Regents serve on behalf of the people of Minnesota, acting as constructive skeptics who support the university above all else, but that support includes inquiry, challenging questions, and, when needed, demanding accountability. The legislature is well-versed in these traits, and a process closer to you will do a better job of instilling these characteristics in the board. Now, I would also note that the current process leads to two very different campaigns. The first is a formalistic and, for many, an uncomfortable campaign based on resumes and oftentimes relationships with members of the RCAC. In fact, as we heard, some candidates themselves and through third parties lobby RCAC members for support. The second campaign is with legislators. You ask questions about how the university is serving Minnesota. Why is there no longer an agronomy degree? Why are inner city students being denied access by admission standards? Why is the university paying so many high six and seven figure salaries at a time when tuition is growing exponentially? Are we providing enough support for our system campuses? The best approach to region selection should be through meaningful dialogue with legislators about region candidates' vision for the university and how our flagship land-grant research university serves people all across the state. The current process appears to have stood in the way of that dialogue in many instances. I would be happy to address any questions the committee may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rocha. Oh, Representative Whalen, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Regent Rocha, for your testimony. I actually have four questions. I'm not sure if they're best directed to you or maybe the testifiers that went before us, but I just want to make sure I'm clear. When we say that when you mentioned that the legislature or that the RCAC didn't put forward an incumbent, those individuals in the mid-90s that had been elected, had been deemed qualified, then all of a sudden weren't recommended, was there a public statement from the RCAC on why?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Second question, Mr. Chair, thank you. Second question, why did the RCAC not interview you? Were you given a reason why they chose not to interview you?
Regent Bolsha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry for my abrupt answer in the previous question. No. I received a very polite call from a member of RCAC who, very professional and kind, saying, I regret to inform you that you are not being interviewed. And I, really, I'll bet that isn't where I expected all of this to go down, but I guess that's the case because I just sort of presume that a former member of the board and a small pool of candidates that it would warrant a full and robust inquiry into all of the people that had applied. And six people apply. You're not going to interview all six when you have the opportunity to recommend four qualified candidates. But it wasn't my decision to make, and no reason was given.
Representative Whelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the last two, I'll read them together, and if they're better answered by others, maybe they can catch me after the committee as well. But the first one relates to the keeping all of the position opens, all of the candidate positions open for further applications, even though they really only wanted applications for the 8th district. The question would be why did they not close the other candidate seats that were available, as those did have enough? And then the other question is regarding what Regent Rocha stated about the background checks and calling of individuals, and if something negative is reported, my understanding from your testimony is that the RCAC does not need to tell you what that is. They do not need to tell you who said it. They do not need to tell you why. So in essence, you have absolutely no way of responding to potential allegations on your character or et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My intent in visiting today, and I know that some of my comments are fairly pointed, and I feel bad because I have great respect for my colleagues who spoke earlier. But you know, we all hear these concerns, right? And I just thought, well, who's going to stand up and speak to them? And I kind of feel like maybe I might be in somewhat of a unique position, considering my history here and what's happened in the last couple of cycles. I tried to stay with the objective facts. I have strong opinions as to why things were done. Certainly one could surmise that I wasn't interviewed because somebody may have had another candidate in mind. And so having a smaller pool of candidates would advantage the prospect that the person that they would prefer would be elected. I don't think of myself necessarily as that, you know, well-connected. I'm not wealthy, and I don't really get that involved in politics. But I think that may have been part of it. As far as why were they all kept open, well, I think the results kind of speak for themselves. You know, I mean, if the goal was really this seat, you'd think that one could have certainly, you know, because one person did actually, I understand, run, was nominated in that, you know, at the committee meeting. But, seven. And I want to say there might have been one or two in one of the other two, but I think it might have only been those seven. I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to go check that. But my sense is there was a pretty aggressive effort. And I was getting calls from folks, you know, saying, hey, I got this call from so-and-so because they thought this person might be in a position to challenge my capacity to be reelected back to the board. And so, you know, I certainly have my suspicion. And could it be just random happenstance? Perhaps. I think that's a bit unlikely. And then when you talk about calling of individuals, so in 15 when the effort came about, after I was endorsed by the third, after not being interviewed or recommended by the council, and some folks then, you know, pulled my application out and started calling folks, even though the rules say that it stays closed. This is just by way of example of how dangerous this is if people have a motivation other than what I think is ultimately intended. I all of a sudden started getting calls from former colleagues from the board who I hadn't listed as references saying, I got this very strange call. And one of them quoted that he was very uncomfortable and he used the term hatchet job. Another person who is a very accomplished woman in town I listed as a reference said she was so uncomfortable with the questions being asked that she started recording the call. I don't think that's right. You know, and it certainly, so then in 17, you know, what would you do? You know, you've served a couple of years. You're proud of the fact that the university is making some progress in certain respects, certainly a lot of work to do. I've got to now go in front of this council that, in my view, clearly has an animus towards my campaign, but has some sort of there is this kind of mentality about what kind of people, you know, who they want. You know, and when you think about it, and I'm a lifetime member of a life member of the Alumni Association and so on, you know, you have to ask, is the real intent to provide citizen input or is the real intent to provide association input? Who are the people that are being positioned to be on these councils? You know, we have RCAC people come to board meetings. I don't think RCAC is the overlord for the regions. I think it's supposed to help the legislature identify quality candidates to serve on the board and exercise good judgment. That's what I believe. And so, you know, maybe I'm wearing a tinfoil hat on some of this stuff, but it just seems that the track record of the last couple of years gives me the basis to think that it isn't always being operated the way I think the legislature intended and the way that the vast majority of members of RCAC are operating individually.
We have just a few more minutes. Representative Jessup.
Thank you, Chair Norris. And thank you for appearing before us. Representative Haley and I are both freshmen, and so we've gone through this process together, but I echo her words. This is a very, very convoluted process. And what concerns me from your testimony and also going through the process is it seems like there is no trust in the candidates that are recommended by RCAC. And I think of searches that occur all throughout our country. Even think about how do we go about the process of choosing a new president for the University of Minnesota. How do we go about that process of choosing a new CEO for, let's say, Ecolab or other company? We typically will go to an outside firm that specializes in searches for executives. And they have no objective other than providing the best candidate for that particular position. And I hear your testimony, and I'd ask kind of your recommendation. If we did not have RCAC, by which we have heard there can be agendas from some of the members of RCAC, is there another process that you might consider, given your expertise, by which quality candidates could be delivered to the joint, you know, the joint convention to really vet those small list of candidates? That's my question.
Richard Rocha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jessup, it's a fantastic question, and, you know, I certainly have my opinions about it. I kind of like Minnesota's unique process of the legislature electing, but my concern is that when you put that layer in there, a lot of legislators, you guys are so busy, and we talked, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I think there may be a constitutional issue with which years, you know, the election occurs and so on. But it's, for some legislators, I think it separates them from the process a little bit. And I do think that dialogue with Representative Pryor, and as short as it is, I think that's important. You know, most states, it's gubernatorial appointment, right? And so, I mean, that's certainly going to be political. I mean, who knows who and so on. But, you know, I do think that there are some things that have been very positive out of RCAC. I think the recruitment and sort of systemizing the application, you know, so it's maybe just a little bit less amorphous. I don't know that amorphous is necessarily bad, but at least this way you kind of know who's putting themselves forward generally. I think that recruitment and maybe some basic background check, you know, of the criminal variety and so on, I think that would make a certain amount of sense. But, this isn't a business in the typical sense. It's not a big corporation where the bottom line is the bottom line. It is a public institution. It is a public service to serve as a regent. I think it's a public service to serve as the president. When I was on the board in the early 90s, the president made the same as the governor. You know, you could feed a family on that kind of money in 1990, but now it's gone up by a factor of 8. You know, so I don't really know how that decision was made to sort of turn it into sort of more of this kind of commercial enterprise as opposed to a public service as well as a pretty well-compensating position. I think you're going to lose that the farther you get from you. I think legislators, in knowing what your constituents want and what your constituents need from the University of Minnesota, I think that improves that. And I also think that I would prefer that the regents, generally over time, and I'm not making any specific, you know, allusions here, I think they should see you as the source. You know, you're our electors. We should be having a close relationship and understanding what you think, and you provide, not only do you elect the regents, but you also provide a huge part of our budget. I understand your desire to find that sort of that way of really, you know, feeling good that you've got this unbiased, clear process of finding talent, but I don't think that process is necessarily going to find someone that understands that, you know, kids from Lanesboro aren't getting into the university anymore, or that, you know, kids from North Minneapolis don't find that this is an environment that's welcoming to them for education. I, you know, there those kinds of things, I think the legislature is the best suited entity in the state to provide that kind of input to the board.
One follow-up, Representative Jessup.
One follow-up. One point of clarification, Chair. I would certainly not go away from the legislative process on this. It's more a matter of if the criteria that is desired is to provide to the legislature a candidate slate of four individuals, could that vetting process to get to that slate of four individuals perhaps be handled by an independent entity rather than the RCAC?
Brief answer, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can speculate that it's a possibility. My concern is that if they are not in tune with the perspective of the legislature at that time with respect to the university, you might end up in somewhat of the same situation, maybe without the machinations of a political nature, but nonetheless you might find yourself off azimuth for what the legislature is looking for the board. But certainly something to be considered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. I thank everyone that presented today. It's helpful. We could have continued this discussion, I think, for a long time. And it will probably continue offline. So with that, members, we are adjourned.